with parent law, which got accepted just recently in Archive for Mathematica. You can download it from my website if you want to have the paper. So the motivation is the theorem of Farrazzani and Smith of 54 that says that every compact operator T from some infinite dimensional Banach space X has a proper invariant subspace, and by proper it means that it sits strictly between, this is why it's finite or infinite dimensional, sits strictly between 0 and x, and by invariant means that T of y is subset of y. And there's a generalization by Lomonosov, of course, in 73 of this theorem. A generalization of compact operators are the strictly singular ones, which I will abbreviate to SS, which, and the definition, there are a lot of them, but the one that will be useful for the talk will be, if I have an operator T from a space to another space, all of these are infinite, both of them, well, the main at least, infinite dimensional, then it's strictly singular if for every Z infinite dimensional subspace of Y, and for every, let me give two definitions. There is a W infinite dimensional subspace of Z, such that if you restrict the operator on W, so now it goes from W to X, it's compact. So this definition shows you that compact are strictly singular. And it's equivalent to also that for every Z infinite dimensional subspace of Y, and for every epsilon positive, there is a W infinite dimensional subspace of Z, such that if you restrict the operator on W, you make it small norm. So a question, so these are generalizations of compact operators, so the question which was open until 3 years ago, it was solved 3 years ago, was if T is strictly singular, does it have a proper invariant subspace? Does T, and T goes from X to X, does T have a proper invariant subspace? And this was solved in the negative in 1999 by Reed, who proved that not necessarily there is a non-reflexive X, and there is a bad operator on X, strictly singular, but with no proper invariant subspace. So one has to make the question different. So the question one, question two. What about if X is reflexive and T from X to X is strictly singular, does T have a proper invariant subspace? So this is the motivation for what this is the motivation for what I will speak. And this is a trivial remark that says that if I have an operator from a space to itself, and I have, so let an operator from a space to itself, and let a non-zero vector in X, such that if you restrict the operator T on the space generated by all the powers T to the N of X, N in N, and this will be called infinite orbit of, this will be called the infinite orbit of X through the operator T. If this is compact, then, so if you can find an infinite orbit starting from a non-zero vector, so that the operator restricted there is compact, then T has a proper invariant subspace. The proof is trivial. If T is compact, then T has a proper invariant subspace by the theorem of Farazani-Smith. If T is not compact, since this is compact, then the subspace you restrict it to must be different than the whole space. So this is proper. But always the orbits are invariant, so you have a proper invariant subspace. So after this remark, let me state the main theorem that we proved, that says that if I have T, some operator acting on an infinite dimensional Banach space, being strictly singular and one-to-one, then okay, what's the conclusion? That for every Y infinite dimensional subspace of X, there exists a Z infinite dimensional subspace of X that has three properties. So such that there are three properties satisfied. That the dimension of Z intersection Y is infinite, right? That Z contains orbits of T of any finite length, which means for every n, there exists an orbit of length n starting from some point, let's call it Zn, the starting point, and has length n, stops it there, which is subset of Z. And the third property has three properties, that T restricted on Z is compact. So you see, if we had an infinite orbit, and if Z has an infinite orbit and this is compact, by this remark, the operator would have invariant subspace, but of course we couldn't have such a general theorem. You see the theorem of Fried. You had to put extra assumptions on X in order to hope for such a thing to be true. So this is the theorem. Now what kind of, yes, sorry. Actually, this would be the span of Zn would be here.
So the starting point.
R in Y, yeah. Okay. Right. The starting point is called the. Examples of strictly singular operators that I have in mind, there are a lot of examples, but the main examples that I have in mind, they come from the HI spaces, so which have been defined today by Ted O'Dell, I think. So if I have X hereditarily in decomposable space, then every operator from X to X can be written as multiple of the identity plus another operator which is strictly singular. So the reason, and this space has been studied a lot recently, Spiros Argyros has, with co-authors, has many theorems, and other people, some of them here have a lot of theorems. If I try to mention people, probably I will forget. These are the spaces, these are the operators I have in mind that I might be able to apply the theorem, because some of these spaces, X, are reflexive. So if the question 2 can be answered in the positive, since this is the motivation of our theorem, if the question 2 can be answered in the positive, then the corollary that comes from this answer would be that the invariant subspace problem would be that every reflexive HI space is the solution to the invariant subspace problem. So that's why I'm interested mainly in this space, because the strictly singular operators are more or less all of them. So let's go to the proof of the theorem. I will try to sketch the idea of the proof, which is actually very simple. It's just to write it down, it gets technical, but the idea is very simple. So let's start with an operator T from X to X, which is strictly singular. By the way, this one-to-one assumption, I don't know if it's necessary there. I try to prove the result without having the one-to-one assumption, but it gets very technical. And on the other hand, I didn't mind to have this assumption, because for the invariant subspace problem, it's enough to check it for one-to-one operators. If it's not one-to-one, then it's going to have invariant subspace. So if the assumption one-to-one can be removed from there, this will give a characterization of strictly singular operators. I don't know if that's possible to be removed, but it might be. Let's prove the theorem. So let's start with a T from X to X being strictly singular one-to-one, and let's take Y infinite dimensional subspace of X. So I want to construct this space Z, infinite dimensional space Z of X. So what's the natural way to construct the Z? So Z contains the orbits of T of finite length. And the natural way is, so construct a sequence Zn, which has the starting points of these finite orbits. So construct a sequence Zn in Y, and this will be the starting points of the finite orbits. This will be some normalized linearly independent sequence, normalized linear independent sequence, and in Y, and then set Zn to be the n-dimensional space spanned by the orbit of length n, starting with the point little zn, okay, so I have these finite dimensional subspaces, and then put all of these finite dimensional subspaces together to make the space Z. So this space Z will definitely contain orbits of any finite length, and will definitely satisfy the first property. And the only question is how to make sure that it will satisfy the last property. How to make sure if you start with a strictly singular one-to-one operator, you can find these finite dimensional orbits so that the operator is strictly there to be compact. Okay, here is a trivial property that if it's satisfied, it's going to be compact. So such that the following property is satisfied. For every x in Z, Z is the space, of norm 1, if you write the x as the sum of xn, where xn belongs to the nth dimensional finite subspace, we have that. So I'm saying something about the projections to the Zn's here. say that this is uniformly bounded, say number 17 or 4 or something, and the P shrinks the pieces. Okay? Let's call this property P. So it's really trivial, it's undergraduate analysis, to see that if this property is satisfied, so you want to have some property, you have some finite dimensional spaces, you paste them together, so of course T restricted to each finite dimensional space is going to be compact. You paste them together and you want to make sure that the operator restricted, the operator on the union is going to be compact. And this is trivial really to see that this is enough to make the operator compact in the union, in ZIM. So P implies T is compact. It's trivial. So the question is, how do we choose now the ZN so that this property P is satisfied? Okay, now you want to know that T shrinks the vectors that come from every subspace. So you want to, in order to make, to satisfy this kind of property, you have to know if you write a vector as the sum of Xn, and each Xn belongs to the nth dimensional finite subspace, so you write the Xn with respect to these vectors, there will be a lot of n coefficients that appear there. You want to make sure that you can bound those coefficients sufficiently. So it's very natural to define what is the maximum of the coefficients that you use. So we define the following thing, that if we have norm 1 vectors, finitely many, then we define the bi-orthogonal constant let's call it BC of X1 XN to be the sup of the maximum of the coefficients every time that the norm of the sum happens to be 1. So we want to control the coefficients. So we define the bi-orthogonal constant. And the lemma that we have says that if I have, okay, so this is the technical lemma, which is the hard try, how do we get this property P, how do we construct the ZN to satisfy property P, that if I have P from X to X strictly singular one-to-one, and I have Y infinite dimensional subspace of X, and I have F finite codimensional subspace of X, and I have N in N, and I have epsilon positive, then, if I have all of these, then I can find a vector X in Y of norm 1 such that three properties are true. If you take all of these quotients, I make noise with this thing. Sorry. I hear myself. All right. So if you take the technology doesn't like me. If I take these n quotients, all of them are smaller than epsilon. Three properties I want to write down. Second property, if I have Tx, T of x, T squared x up to T to the n of x, all of these belong to the finite codimensional subspace. And third property is I can control the bi-orthogonal constant of, okay, X is norm 1, and I normalize all the rest. Okay. Okay, so let's think what does that mean. I want to have these properties. So if I have a strictly singular one-to-one operator, and I have also this finite two-dimensional subspace, and somebody gives me the n and the epsilon, all right? So I want to find a starting point x in y. The x will be my dn, because I'm going to use induction to construct these dn's in a moment. I want to find the starting point x in y of norm 1 so that the norm q of x over x and all of these quotients are smaller than epsilon. All of these vectors belong to x, and all of the vectors that appear in the orbit, the bi-orthogonal constant of them is smaller than 1 over square root of epsilon. It's very important that, okay, this is going to blow up, 1 over square root of epsilon blows up, but it doesn't blow faster than this shrinks. This is important, that the ratio, if you multiply them together, you get square root of epsilon, which goes to 0. All right, so that's the point of that lemma. Now, assume that I have proved the lemma, how can I, okay, then if I have proved the lemma, then how do I construct those ZMs to make sure that the property is satisfied? So inductively then, meaning after I prove the lemma, inductively define Z1 to be the span of little Z1 and T of Z1. Well, the first step really is kind of more or less trivial without really using the lemma. Z2, the inductive step is important. The span of Z2, T of Z2, and T squared of Z2, etc. So what is the, how do I use it? So assume that, what is the inductive step? Assume that I have constructed capital Z1 up to capital Zn minus 1. How do I construct the capital Zn? So I apply the lemma for a certain f and a certain epsilon. The f that I applied, what's the f? What's the finite two-dimensional subspace that I apply the lemma? I take a set of functionals every time. So I take Z1 I star, a set of norm 1 functionals that say two norms, the space Z1. And then I take, these are finitely many, Z2 I star norm 1 functionals that two norms, Z1 plus Z2, etc. I have taken Zn minus 1 I star that norms Z1 plus Z2 plus Zn minus 1. And then I take Fn, say at the end step, I take the finite codimensional subspace to be the intersection of the kernels of all of these functionals. Finitely many functionals. So I have a finite codimensional subspace. And what is my epsilon n? Epsilon n, say, would be 1 over 10 to the n. Okay, so something like that. So and then this theorem will give me the x, and that x will be the zn. And the zn determines the capital zn, and then I continue to find a capital zn plus 1 similarly. So I want to prove that, indeed, the way that I constructed them, the property p is satisfied. How do I prove that the property P is satisfied? Well, I take a vector X in Z. Z, I will set then what I wrote here. Z will be the span of the union. And I will write it as sum of Xn, where the Xn will belong to Zn for every n. Now, let's compute the norm of Xn. If you want to compute the norm of the partial sum, x1 plus xn, that can be computed approximately using one of these norming functionals. So that would be, say, xn I star applied to x1 plus xn. That's why I picked those norming functionals. But the norming functionals are zero on the, this norming functional is zero on Zn plus 1 or Zn plus 2 they are zero because every time I increase my family, if you look there, so I can write this, so this is zero, so I can write it as xni star of x. I can add the rest of the vectors without loss of generality, and then I can use Holder's norm of xni star norm of x, both are one. So the partial sums are bounded, so each term is bounded. I don't know, two. So each term is bounded because the partial sums are bounded. But now I was using the lemma for my epsilon n. So that means if I write, okay, each xn belongs to zn. So each xn can be written as sum ami t to the I of zn normalized. Because these vectors span the finite dimensional space Zn, and this has norm 2, so the AIs have norm, have absolute value at most 2 over square root of epsilon n, because 1 over square root of epsilon n is the bi-orthogonal constant of those vectors here. Okay, so let's apply now t to x, and then the t, so the x is written as summation ani t to the I of zn normalized. If you apply t to that, then you make this I plus 1. And then let's use triangle inequality. You apply it only to the xn, not to the sum of the xn. I'm sorry. Erase the sum. You apply it to the xn. And then you use, so the xn is what I wrote here. This is the xn. And then you apply t, so you make it I plus 1 there. And then you use triangle inequality. And then you realize that here what you get are the quotients, which are smaller than epsilon n by the property 1 of the lemma. So this is smaller, this I equals 1 to n. I equals 1 to n, 2 over square root of epsilon n times epsilon n. And the epsilon n was 1 over 10 to the n or something. So this is smaller, 1 over 2 to the n. So I got the property P. So the question is, how do we prove the lemma? Well, spend a couple of minutes on the lemma and then I finish. So how do we prove this lemma? So in order to prove this lemma, we really do it step by step. The lemma has three properties, 1, 2, and 3, that I have to satisfy. So we prove three sublemmas. In the first sublemma, we make sure that the property 1 is satisfied, and then the property 1 and the I can edit underneath. So the proof of lemma goes into three easy, the third step is kind of technical but easy steps. So sublemma one, same assumption as the lemma, implies you cannot really get one vector that has the property one. You get a whole infinite dimensional subspace. So there is an infinite dimensional subspace W of Y that all the vectors of W satisfy the property one, such that for every X in W, of course except the element zero, one is true. And how do you do that? Let me explain how do you do that. Well, say n equals 2, for instance, to make things simpler. So I want to make sure that t of x over x is smaller than epsilon, and t square of x over t of x is smaller than epsilon. Say I want to make sure that these two properties are satisfied for every x in W. Well, the first property means that the norm of t restricted to W is smaller than epsilon. So because t is strictly singular, I have the big space W here, and because t is strictly singular, I can find, say, a W1. So if I restrict t to W1, this is the image here. Well, it shrinks things, like it has norm less than epsilon. This is t of W1. But still infinite dimensional because t is 1 to 1, but the norm of t restricted to W1 is smaller than epsilon. And then this is infinite dimensional, so I can find a further infinite dimensional subspace W2. So if you restrict T there, also the norm is smaller than epsilon. And then I pull back this thing. This is T inverse of W2, and I call it W3, say. I call it W, and that's the W that works for 2. So it's really trivial to get property 1, but you don't get it only for one vector. You get it for a lot of them, for a whole subspace. And then sublemma 2 will be same assumption as the lemma. There's an infinite dimensional subspace W, so that both 1 and 2 are true. And how do you get that? So the proof of sublemma 2 is apply sublemma 1, but instead of applying it for Y, apply it for Y replaced by Y intersection. Instead of Y, you do it for Y intersection T to the minus 1 of codimensional subspace F, intersection T to the minus 2 of F, intersection T to the minus N of F. Well, if you find the vector here, this is non-empty, non-zero, by the way, because this is a finite codimensional subspace, so it must intersect the infinite dimensional subspace Y. So if you find the vector here, then the first N images are going to belong to F by the way that you pick the space Y. So that's how the property 2 is satisfied. And how is the property 3 finally? How do you get the property 3? And you get also the property 2 for a whole subspace. To get the property 3, this is the idea. Well, you start by picking a vector, apply sublemma 2. So you pick a vector x1. There's a whole infinite dimensional subspace W, but just fix one in W, fix x1 in W of norm 1, so that if you take the T of x1, then 1 and 2 is true. So I know that T of x1 over x1 is smaller than epsilon, and T squared of x1 over T of x1 is smaller than epsilon. And you want to be a little bit more careful, so epsilon over 10 or epsilon over 4, something like that, in order to get epsilon at the end. And also, x1 and T of x1 belongs to F. And now you check if the third property is true. If it's true, you are done, of course. Right? If the third property says that this is small, if this is small, you are done. Right? But you might be unlucky and it might be large. So if the bi-orthogonal constant of x1 and T of x1 normalized is large, what does that mean? That means that these two vectors, x1 and T of x1, are almost parallel. Let me make it almost parallel to T of x1. So they look almost parallel. Okay. And then do again sublemma 2, but replace your infinite dimensional subspace F by F. So sublemma 2. Replace F by F intersection the kernel of a bunch of functionals which norm the space generated by x1 and T of x1. So now you find, by sublemma 2, you find another vector, x2. And this x2, by sublemma 2, is going to belong to the kernel of those functionals. So you can think of it as being perpendicular to both of these two vectors. So you find it, and now you not only do it for F replaced by this, but you do it for epsilon prime, much, 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 much smaller than epsilon. So the T of x2 cannot really draw it on the board because it's almost zero. And then your x that you are looking for is simply the sum of x1 and x2 normalized. So if you normalize this, then basically the T of x is, because the T of x2 is approximately zero, the T of x is up to a factor 2, the same as the T of x1. You see? So the t of x is approximately equal to the t of x1 and the t squared of x2 of x will be approximately equal to the t squared of x1. So when you want to compute the bi-orthogonal constant of x and t of x, is the same as up to a factor 4 or something to compute the bi-orthogonal constant of keep the x and replace here the x by x1. Actually, I don't need that. But see, the x is a diagonal of this rectangle, and the x1 is almost parallel to x1. So these two are far away from being parallel, so the bi-orthogonal constant must be small. So you're done. So that's the vector that you pick. And you have to do a longer induction for longer ends.